Good morning, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Erin Yoshimura, and I am the host for this session. And just so you know if you're in the right session or not, this session is Past Present, How Children's Books, Book Writers Make History Relevant for Young Readers. And today's moderator is Naomi Hirahara. And Naomi was born and raised in Southern California and is the Edgar Award-winning author of Moss Orai mystery series, Summer of the Big Bachi, Gasa Gasa Girl, and Snakeskin Shamisen, which features a Japanese-American gardener and atomic bomb survivor. A previous editor of the Rafu Shimpo newspaper, she has also produced 7 nonfiction books on local horticulture and Asian-American history. Her short stories are in 3 anthologies, Los Angeles Noir, A Hell of a Woman, and The Darker Mask. Delacorte will release her middle grade book right here, 1001 Cranes. You can purchase it today and get her to sign it.
No.
Oh,
we can't. It's not available until August.
Oh, it's not available until August. Yeah. So
but you
you're just going to have.
Pre-order it.
But you can pre-order it and yearn for it. Available in 2008, I had read further. She currently serves on the advisory board of the Orange County Agricultural and Nikkei Heritage Museum and the Southern California Chapter of Mystery Writers of America. Her website is www.naomihirahara.com, and it's also in your program book. So without further ado, Naomi.
Hello, everybody. I just have to warn you, I'm more of an informal person, so I don't have a laid-out speech or anything. And we want this to be really interactive and as well. I have the pleasure of moderating this panel, and I'm really excited about our 2 panelists. To my immediate left is, of course, you probably all know her, Cynthia Karahata. And she's really a pioneer in terms of Japanese-American contemporary fiction writers. She has a number of short stories published. When was, about what decade, were like The New Yorker and all that?
Mid-80s.
Like the mid-80s. And of course, her groundbreaking, her debut novel was Floating World. And Cynthia is born in Chicago, and she's lived all over the nation because her father was a chicken sexer. And some of that experience comes into play in that debut novel, Floating World. And she wrote two books for grown-ups subsequently. And then she made a transition to writing books for young readers. And her first attempt, Kira Kira, went on to win the Newbery Award, which those who know about children's literature, that's kind of like the Oscar, you know, of this field. Her next book was called Weed Flower, and that's kind of how we got to know each other in LA when she was doing research into the flower growing. And that book, of course, you must all be familiar with it, takes place mostly in the post detention center and talks about that experience. And I think the state of Arizona made it their book of the year. Her next book after that was Cracker. What's the subtitle of that book?
The Best Dog in Vietnam.
Yeah, The Best Dog of Vietnam. And that's a wonderful book that, again, tells about an unknown history, about how dogs were very instrumental in helping soldiers during Vietnam War. And her latest book, and you could show everybody, is Outside Beauty. And this is, it's a fascinating book. I haven't read it yet, but I know the premise is these sisters who have different fathers kind of are separated and have to find themselves again. And it's very interesting because Cynthia often talks about the love among siblings and all that. So we are so happy to have Cynthia here. So thank you. The other person we have on the panel is Uma Krishnaswamy. I do want to say this because we're a predominantly Japanese-American crowd. And I know, like many of us, we've had our last name massacred, right? And I don't get too upset because I always have to ask myself, how diligent am I to learn, you know, the names, of different ethnic groups? And I'm not the best, you know, so I think it kind of calls all of us. And it's kind of connected with the plenary session that it's not only about our story, but it's about a multicultural America. And we do need to know other stories as well. So, Uma, and I learned how to pronounce her name. She referred me to this website, and it's really wonderful. And this could be kind of a tool for educators as well as authors. And it's a little podcast of Uma explaining how to pronounce her name and what it means. And it's really wonderful. You could talk to her later about that. And Uma was born in New Delhi, India, but her home now is here in New Mexico. And she has written more than a dozen books. And what's really fascinating is they range from picture books to easy readers to middle grade to young adult. And if you're unfamiliar with these categories, we can discuss that a little later. And what I find fascinating about Uma's work, and I first became familiar with her work through a small press called the Children's Book Press that is out of San Francisco that does a lot of multicultural literature. Her other works include The Broken Tusk, published by August House, Monsoon, Pharaoh Strauss Giro, and The Happiest Tree, A Yoga Story, Lee and Lo. And what's also interesting about Uma is she's a teacher. In addition to her writing, she teaches at a low residency program, the Vermont College of Fine Arts, in the MFA program in writing for children and young adults. So if you're interested in maybe pursuing writing, you might talk to her afterwards. Before we start, I want to just ask in the audience, how many of you are interested in writing a book for young readers or are interested? Please raise your hand high. Okay. How many people are educators? Okay. And then how many people like reading? Okay. Okay, so that's the unifying thing. So we'll try to address both those audiences. Before I ask questions, and we're going to leave plenty of time at the end for Q&A, I do want both of them to read a little snippet of their writing so you can get a taste if you're unfamiliar. I also want to mention later this afternoon there will be a specific reading and signing of both of these authors. And you can get their books at the Tattered Cover booth that's way on the side of the marketplace. So let's start by Cynthia.
Hi, this is the first couple of pages of my new book. It's my first young adult book. Previously, I wrote what's called middle grade books, so that's for a younger audience. And this one is for, you know, older kids. "Please," my little sister said, "please, let me push you in the shopping cart. I promise you won't fall." "No," I said. Maddie was one of those kids with big, persuasive eyes, like a doll's. But a couple of boys from the school happened to be across the alley, and I didn't want them seeing me in a shopping cart. I wasn't wearing my glasses because I wanted to look cute for them. "Please," Maddie said. "Oh, all right." Those boys didn't like me anyway. I climbed into the cart and watched Maddie's face brighten, then scrunt up with the concentrated effort of pushing me. She started running. Suddenly, the cart came to a halt, and the next thing I knew, my head thumped on the sidewalk, and the shopping cart crashed against my nose. "Ow, you said I wouldn't fall," I said. "I'm sorry, I'm sorry." There was a huge crack in the ground. Maddie helped get me off the cart, get the cart off. "Your nose is bleeding. Yours would be too," I said. But I wasn't too hurt to glance at the boys. They hadn't made a move to help. They were watching me and laughing. As my mother liked to say, some men just have no manners.
Thank you. And Uma?
I'm going to read from Chatterjee's Cup, which is a picture book. Now I'm getting to that point where I need glasses to read. It's very annoying. Mm-hmm. "When cups clinked in the kitchen and the water rolled to a boil, everyone in my family knew it was tea time. I set the table. My parents took care of the tea leaves. But as long as he lived with us, and that was as long as I could remember, it was Chachaji, my father's old uncle, who was in charge of tea time. Plain tea today, Neil, he'd ask me, or shall we have masala chai, and cloves and nutmeg flavors would sing along with the boiling water. My friend Daniel often came to tea at our house. He loved the cucumber sandwiches Mom made and the crisp little cookies from the Indian store. Chachaji called them biscuits. Chachaji would tip food onto our plates and milk into our cups. He'd pour in just enough tea to make the spice flavors dance in our mouths. Then, as we all ate and talked, he'd sip slowly and noisily from his old china teacup. Its white surface was creamy smooth with a spray of pink roses. Its faded gold trim was chipped in spots. It was the only teacup he ever drank from. Once I forgot and brought him another cup. "No, Beta," he told me, "that's the wrong one." "You really love that old cup," I said to him. "Old cup for an old man," said Chatterjee, and he slurped his tea as the steam rose in little curly waves about his silver head. It was his mother's, Mom told me, your great-grandmother's.
Thank you very much. I wanted to start off the session by talking a little bit just about their path of publication. And first of all, Cynthia, you know, you were writing these three books for adult audiences, then you made this, I know you're going to continue, but you made this transition to writing these three or four books for young readers. Can you explain how that happened and how it was for you in terms of, did you have to adjust your writing voice for this different audience?
Well, my three books for grown-ups are all from the point of view of young women, so it was really a pretty easy transition to start writing about kids. We're writing from the viewpoint of kids. I always did that anyway. And I made the transition, though, officially, because my former grad school roommate is named Caitlin, and she went on to become a children's book editor. And she's the one who suggested that I write a book for kids. So I wrote a book for kids, and then after I finished, she gave me a contract for two more books. So she was really my sort of transition focal point.
And then with Uma, you've written books for all ages. And then can you just explain your approach? How do you decide something's like a picture book versus a novel for young adults versus like this middle grade? How do you make that decision?
I don't always. In fact, a lot of the time when I start writing, I don't know what the story is going to end up being. When I started writing and submitting for publication, and I have to back up a little bit and say I actually have written pretty much all my life. I wrote a lot when I was a child, but I never thought of myself as a writer because I thought you had to be white and dead, really. So it took me a long time to come around to this. But when I first started, I was in love with picture books because they're so beautiful. How could you not be in love with them? And so I thought everything I was going to write was going to be a picture book. And I started, I think, trying to cram a lot of really large stories into this very small container that, and many of my stories early on didn't work for that reason. And I still often don't know what something's going to be. But if I've written enough of it, then it sort of finds its own voice. And if I listen hard enough to that voice, then I can tell it's, you know, this is for a young reader. This is really a story that has something darker or deeper at its core. It's going to need more pages than that.
So Uma, you kind of backed up. Cynthia, why don't you back up and just tell us, I mean, were you writing as a child and how kind of your journey to writing happened?
I actually majored in journalism in college. I had dropped out of high school and I got a job as a waitress at a Bob's Big Boy. Because the reason I got the job was because my mom said if I was going to drop out, I had to get a job. And so I got the job, and it was such hard work that I asked my mom if I could go back to school. And she said, okay. And that's when I went back to college, majored in journalism, and knew I wanted to write for the rest of my life.
But you weren't really writing as a child or teenager?
No, as a child, I did write this really stupid story. In fact, I'll tell you what it was called. It was called The One-Legged Ducks. And it was about these ducks with one leg each, and they lived on another planet. It was so stupid. And that was the first story I sent out. I sent that to the Atlantic Monthly, and of course, they sent me a rejection letter.
And with Uma, I mean, since we're talking about publication, I know you probably have questions later about that, but a lot of your, especially your picture books, have been published by more multicultural publishers like Lee and Lowe and the Children's Book Press. And can you just explain, like, how did you approach them directly, or did you do it through an agent, or how did that all happen?
I didn't have an agent when I first got started, and so I actually initially started with retold traditional stories, like retelling folk tales. I think I was smart enough at the time to know that I was a terrible plotter, and I needed an apprenticeship, you know, with some way to learn about the craft of story. So I wrote a lot of, and the market at that time, this was like probably early 90s, was really big on retold traditional tales, what's typically called folk tales, although I'm not quite sure I like that word a whole lot. And so I did not have an agent, and I sent directly to presses that seemed as if they would be interested in that kind of work, which is how my first books got published. I subsequently had an agent for a while, and now I'm actually agentless again, which is a happy resolution for the agent and for myself at this time.
In terms of writing for children, I think some people perceive that there are certain rules. For instance, that your protagonist needs to be young. And many of these books for young readers are in first person. And I think also some people think, oh, it has to be all happy, you know, have a happy ending. And in what ways have you broken these rules, and in what ways have you celebrated them? Why don't you start?
I haven't. I've sort of broken all the rules, I guess, in terms of books having to be happy or teach you a lesson. I mean, the character does have to change, but that's true of grown-up books too. Your character goes through, you know, a change in her or his life, and so in that respect, I've remained true to, you know, plot and storytelling. But otherwise, in terms of having a happy ending, I really didn't. Kira Kira has kind of a bittersweet ending. Mm-hmm. So, and the same is true of Cracker and Weed Flower. I didn't realize that. It's a
melancholy.
It's a pattern. Yes.
We could psychoanalyze you. How about with you?
I don't know about happy endings. Since I never know my ending when I start the story, I guess I have to figure out what it is as I go along. My middle grade novel, Naming Maya, doesn't have an entirely happy ending. It's sort of bittersweet. Chachaji's Cup doesn't have a happy ending. A couple of my picture books do kind of have happy endings, but their subjects are lighter, and that leads naturally to those endings. I think that it's the story has its own pattern as you write it. You discover where it needs to go and where it needs to stop.
How about the whole some of your books are about intergenerational relationships. I mean, do you purposely try to tell it from the child's point of view, or how do you tackle point of view issues?
Yeah, my books do tend to focus on the young protagonist, the child at the heart of the story. I'm trying to think. They're not all in first person. Some are in third. And again, I don't always know that when I get started either. Sometimes I have to write the whole story in first person and then go back and change it and see how it sounds. And then I can get a sense of what I need to use. But they're almost all from fairly close to the young character.
And I, you know, from writing, I also wanted to delve it, because there's many educators in the audience talking about history. And how do you select the historic topics that you write about? Do you see kind of a need and then you seek to fill it? Or do the stories or characters come first? And you could, you know, use an example, you know, a real example from one of your books if you choose to.
Actually, I just write about whatever I'm interested in. And I send my editor a proposal, and she tells me if she thinks it's good or if it's bad, she just doesn't answer me. And then I remind her, and she said, oh, right. But otherwise, I sent her proposals, and once I sent her a letter for my book, Cracker, The Best Dog in Vietnam, I just sent her an email. It was really about this long, and she bought the book on the basis of that short email, which is really unusual for me. It's never happened before.
And how about you, Uma?
Okay, let me think. I always have four or five ideas batting around in my head, and I tend to write the things that I'm interested in writing. I've done other kinds of writing where work for hire, where you're actually commissioned to write certain things and then they pay you for it. I've never felt as strongly about those pieces. I've heard Jane Yolen say there are stories that you write that are of the head, and then there are stories of the heart. And I think I've done bits of both.
So how do you write from the heart?
I think if a character doesn't leave you alone, then you have to write it.
Mm-hmm.
I think if stories recur again and again, if you keep a journal or something and you keep find yourself writing the same things over and over, then that's something you really need to pay attention to.
Oh, and you know something else about historical fiction? When I started out, I asked somebody what's considered historical in children's books, and she said the 80s. So, so that's another reason why I write a lot of historical books.
How do you go about once you... You know, your characters are talking to you and you know it's set during a certain time period, for instance, like Weed Flower. How do you go about doing research? I mean, do you do interviews? And, how does that research process work for both of you?
I did a lot of research for the book. And even though I did a lot, I still did not understand my main character, Sumiko. I'm probably saying that wrong. I don't speak Japanese. But... what happened is, even though I didn't understand the character, I brought the manuscript with me to Kazakhstan, where I was adopting a little boy, and I was really lonely. I was displaced, and I felt, just out of touch. I didn't know what was going on around me, and that was kind of the way my character felt. So I scribbled this term about the ultimate boredom. And that was the way I felt in Kazakhstan, and then I also put it into my book. So just what's happening in my real life can really affect my books that way.
How about with you, Uma?
I'm actually working on a historical novel right now that will be published either next year or the year after. We don't know yet. But it's set in Central California, and it's in a community of people where Sikh men came from India and married Mexican women, and there's still a small population of descendants. And so, of course, here I am writing, it's completely out of culture for me. I read an enormous amount. I read journals and sociological studies that somebody had done on this group of people. I read newspaper reports of the time, court cases, just everything I could lay my hands on. But then I got to a point where I had to put the research away, and I had to really sit with my character and figure out, who is this kid and what would she want? What could she have wanted at that time in that place? And I had to do that, because otherwise you can drown in the research.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And then what you have is a really great nonfiction,
narrative. And that's what I want to ask you guys. Have you two ever thought of writing nonfiction ever? Have you?
I haven't thought about it. In college, I wanted to write nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And right after college, I also wanted that. But I was like Uma. I thought it was, written by dead white people. And so then I moved to Boston, and I started reading all this contemporary literature. It's so much, there were just bookstores all over. And so I started reading Anne Beattie, who is white, but she's alive. And that's really what, it was like a nuclear explosion in my mind. I thought I could write fiction about today's world.
And Uma, you're shaking.
I have written nonfiction.
You have written?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, okay.
I wrote a little or easy reader about an Indian holiday called Holi.
And for explain one of what series. Easy reader is.
So this is a whole. This is a category of books. It's completely unique to children's books because, of course, when you write for adults, you don't stop to think. You know, how much does this person read, and can they understand the words I'm putting in here? And in picture books, oddly enough, although they're for very young readers, but they're also for young listeners. You don't think as much about the complexity of language, but easy readers are books that are used in the classroom. And they're used for kids who are learning to read independently. And so they have a very particular structure. And the history to them is that they really were begun by the old Harper and Row in New York with a book called Danny and the Dinosaur. And that sort of launched this other whole form of children's books. They're short, they have pictures, but the pictures exactly illustrate the words. So your narrative has to be very straightforward. And the first draft of that easy reader that I sent off, I was very pleased with myself. I'd gotten this form down. It was like a challenge, you know, to write in this form. I sent it off, and it came back with probably 4 pages of notes. And
it might be longer than the book, huh?
Yeah, really, they were. And the criticism that the language was too lyrical.
Really?
And it was just too poetic. I was reaching for too much, and I really just needed to tell what I had set out to. So I was very annoyed by this. And then it became a real challenge. It was like, I will do this if it's the last thing in my life I do. But it was hard. It's a hard kind of writing to do because it has to be so plain, mm-hmm. and yet it has to be interesting, mm-hmm. even while being very plain.
It's kind of like the haiku of children's books.
I've never thought of it that way.
You know, I think we forget because we're inundated with so many books for kids these days. But there was one time, I mean, remember the Dick and Jane? See Dick run. And Spy, you know, that was kind of the standard for teaching kids to read. And this is what I heard at a workshop for children's book writers was that, you know, I think it was Random House or somebody, mm-hmm. some publisher figured out, you know, this is not a good way to interest kids, you know, in reading. And that's when all, you know, this kind of, so this is a recent phenomenon. This is not something that's, you know, that happened like in the 19th century or anything.
Yeah. It's 1940s, actually. Danny the Dinosaur, I think, is 1940-something.
Okay. Yeah. And, okay, so both of you both primarily write fiction. So do you, but many times they're based in history or real things that have happened. So do you ever struggle on what to fictionalize and what to make, I don't know, quote, authentic or true to the facts?
Oh, I still don't know how to make that decision. It's a constant battle for me to balance the nonfiction and the fiction. And sometimes I'll have to change the timing of something, you know, like say dogs were brought to Vietnam in 1965. I need to change it to 1969, things like that. And I try to put a note in it, an author's note that says I had to change the timing. And so sometimes it just doesn't fit into the story. And that's how I fit. That's all.
Yeah, me too. It's a really hard call because you want to stay true to the history, but the history sometimes, the timelines of things don't always cooperate with this other fictional timeline that you're developing of the character in the story. And it's you have to find a balance, I think.
And then what kind of assumptions do you make about your audience? And what that I mean is, how do you introduce new concepts that maybe young people are not familiar with, but still maintain the integrity of the story? So in other words, you're not just putting this big paragraph like Japanese Americans were incarcerated, you know. It's so didactic that it doesn't become seamless. How do you tackle that issue?
To be honest, I write it as best as I can, and then my editor goes through it and says, you can't have this, you can't have that. So,
thank goodness for editors, really.
How about you, Amy?
Yeah, I don't know. I get to a point in the life of a work that I kind of lose track of that stuff, and at that point, I just throw it all up and say, I'm just going to do the best I can and we'll deal with this later. Mm-hmm. And there's always a later. The great part of working with the publishing house is that they have very sharp people whose job it is to figure out all this stuff. And they don't leave you alone until you get it.
So how do you make the past, I mean, if 1980s is considered history, how do you make the past of interest to a generation that's text messaging and, you know, maybe their attention spans are not that long? How do you do that?
I'm sorry.
How do you make the past of interest to this generation?
I think you just make the character, you just write the character as closely as you can, and people will relate to it because, in a sense, even though it was a while ago, we're still all human beings. And something my mom used to say was, the more specific, the more universal. And I took that to mean that the more specifically I could write about a certain character, the more people would understand whether they were like the character or not, just because, you know, we're all human.
We're also all hardwired for story. We all get story. We get the notion of a narrative that has a beginning and goes on and goes somewhere and has a journey of its own. And to some degree, I have to trust my reader. I have to trust that a reader who is unfamiliar with a setting or a context that I'm writing about is still going to understand that there's a story at its heart.
What are the common questions that your young readers have about your books? I'd like to hear, like, what do they wonder about after reading, like, something like Weed Flower or Kira Kira?
Or, where do you get your ideas? That one I get, I really love.
Yeah. How about the history? Do they have comments about, like, the what's from Weed Flower, what do your readers ask of you about the internment?
I'm trying to think, I haven't gotten a single question about the internment. It's more whether they can relate to the character or not, whether they went through an experience like that or not. And it's so, in a way, some of the letters are really similar. So I think they're writing them for a report in school or something.
And they kind of contact you the day of the report's due. Tell me everything, right?
I think the most extended conversation I ever had with a group of young readers about any of my books was when I was invited to Syracuse recently. And it was a group of students in Syracuse Public Schools in New York who had studied my books as part of a project they were doing on India, and they had prepared these fabulous multimedia presentations on several books. And so I think the questions there were of greater depth, just because they had read these books over time, read them again and again, talked about them, than the usual, where'd your ideas come from, or that was so unfair for this character or something. And what they wanted to know was, They were confused in naming Maya about some of the historical references, and they had one girl said, she said, I had never, she said, she, they talk about World War II in passing in some of those conversations, and she said, I never realized, even though we call it a world war, that really anybody outside America cared. Mm. And I was so astonished by this because I take this knowledge for granted, but I think it goes back to that notion of history being very recent for children.
Right.
You know, when you're 10 years old, the 80s are old.
Mm-hmm. And then what you talked about, these multimedia, I know both of you do a lot of library and school visits. So how have you integrated technology in, like, communicating the content of your books?
I've been working with computers and technology for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. I don't do PowerPoint. I use this little thing in my Apple called Keynote. Mm-hmm. I also did that little
What was the website? This teachers?
Oh, I'm trying to think. Yeah. Contact me and I'll tell you what it was.
Yeah,
teaching writing or something like that. Uh-huh. But they've got this pronunciation guide for
for authors, mm-hmm. where they invite you to send in this little audio clip, and you record it on their site, and you talk about your name and how to pronounce your name and anything else you want to say in 30 seconds or whatever. And I've had a website, you know, stuff like that. I also teach online, which is the other part of how I use technology. And I don't think I could live where I do and do what I do without the internet, between all of the emails that fly back and forth over editing and my teaching, for which I use a couple of different websites.
Well, you know, why don't we open up for questions? I hope, don't be shy, please. We want to have a discussion here. You have any questions about writing a book? Do you have questions about their book specifically, about how to educate or communicate history to young people? Let's get a question from the audience, please. Yes. Okay. Okay, I'll repeat the questions for our audio recording. The question was a movie, in, I guess it was based on a book, right? Nim's Island. Mm-hmm. And I guess the character was Jodie Foster, who was a writer. And I'm not familiar with the work, but I guess she missed a deadline. And it was a big deal. So the question is, well, how do you deal with deadlines? Have you missed them, or what are the ramifications of deadlines, and what do they mean in terms of the publishing world? So,
I always miss deadlines, and you can kind of sense where the final day is when you can do something. So the first time they tell me that I missed a deadline, I know that I still have some time. So I just really push it to the edge of when I think my editor really has to have it.
The mills of publishing grind extremely slowly. At least that's been my experience. Mm-hmm. It takes a long time between signing a contract and having the book actually come out. So it's a fairly leisurely process. And deadlines are the least of my concerns. I think I'm much more concerned about showing up and finding that the story's run away someplace and I can't find it again.
I mean, I could speak to deadlines as well. I think the problem comes when the publisher, because there's so much work before the book is published. There's things they produce, these advanced reading copies, which are galleys, which they send out. It could be 3 to 6 months before the book is out. And they send it out to reviewers. They send it out to, because there's a lot of trade publications in our industry. They send it to book reviewers of newspapers and television and all that, all ahead of time. This is all happening before, you know, you see the book in the bookstore. So, and then they have a sales team, you know, just like how Apple, Steven Jobs goes, this is the new Apple coming out. They're going, this is a new book by Cynthia Okada-Hata coming out, you know. So in that sense, they are, you know, these expectations from the company, right? And so I think that's where it gets kind of thorny, because they need to allow for, you know, all this time, right?
I can speak to one deadline experience that I did have, and this was with Naming Maya, which is a middle grade novel, and it's set in India. It's an Indian American girl going to India with her mother to sell the grandfather's old house, and the publisher decided they needed a glossary, because I used some Tamil language words through the book, and I did the glossary. We did all that. We were ready to go. It was almost to galleys. It was going to the copy editor for the final time, and then they said, "Really, you should also give us a little pronunciation guide that we can put in the back there." So I worked really hard over the pronunciation guide, and then there was one line that we got really snagged over, and that was that I had literal pronunciations for all of the words phonetically transliterated so people could sound them out. And she said, and my editor called and she said, you don't have any emphases in those words. They're all capitalized. And you know, where's the stress? And I said, well, Tamil's not a stress-driven language. It's a syllable-driven language. And linguistically, there's a difference between the two. So you can't say that that syllable is going to be stressed and this one is not, because they're all stressed equally. And we just had this, and the copy editor said, well, that doesn't sound right. And they went off and looked for an expert. So I thought, oh gosh, what am I going to do? So I had to, with 2 days left to get this thing back together, I had to find someone who was an expert in Tamil language instruction to back me up, to make sure that I was, that, and then you start doubting yourself, because I started thinking, well, am I wrong? Do I really not know this? I better find out. So it all worked out, but it was very close, and I was a little rattled by that. But that's the only time I've ever had a deadline issue.
Questions? Yes. Let me repeat the question. It was directed to Cynthia Karahata regarding her book Weed Flower, set in Poston detention camp, that the protagonist, Sumiko, was not a wild person, but her friends who were in camp were kind of wild. So your question was, why was Sumiko like that, or why her friends were like that? Yeah, why her friends were like that.
That was based directly on interviews. A lot of people said that the kids in Poston got a little wild because they didn't have family in the same way. When they ate at the mess hall, they didn't sit with their family. Sometimes they didn't eat with their family. They ate instead with friends, and they lost a lot of discipline in the camps. And so that was entirely based on research.
So how did that make you feel to read about the wild kids? Could you relate to them, or were you wondering? You're wondering? Okay. So I think, you know, that question in itself is just evidence of the power of children's literature, that maybe if you read it nonfiction, you know, the children were separated from their parents and sometimes acted up, you know, maybe that wouldn't really resonate with a child. But if you read the story, it's like, oh, okay, I get it. There's a question over there. Yes.
You know, I can speak a little bit to that kind of writing because
let me just repeat the question, or you could repeat the question and answer it.
Okay, I'll try to repeat this as best as I can. You asked about a guide that you're trying to write to an internment camp site, and hoping that it's also going to be an educational publication that can be used in the schools, and also can be placed in hotels and so forth as an introduction to this site for people who visit Denver. Is that right? I worked for a little while. I live in Aztec, New Mexico, and we have an ancestral pueblo, so-called Anasazi site, right in town, and different kind of Indian altogether for me. But when I first moved to the area, I was invited to run writing workshops for children at that site. And it was an amazing experience. And one of the things that came from that was we worked with a teen group, and they actually wrote portions of a guide that could then be used with young visitors So I think there might be some way to include children's writings and children's words in a publication like that. I think that sometimes is the connecting point. So I don't know if that answers.
I've heard other sites using kind of, I hate to use scavenger hunt, but it's like an interpretive guide, but it's kind of telling, look for this kind of writing on this concrete pond, or so in other words, there's, you know, kind of clues, so they're kind of, oh, you said that there's no site right now, so that could be an issue, yeah. Kate, do you have anything to comment on that from your experience with Manzanar?
No, I'm sorry. Okay.
Does anyone have any comments to that question? Yes.
Interesting and a little bit different from, quote, a book. And it's quicker and easier.
Does anyone else have a comment? Okay, question. Oh, yeah. What, Carrie, maybe you could just have Carrie. Okay.
A question.
Yeah.
But if we're still on that.
No. Okay, go ahead, ask you.
I'm jumping many stages ahead.
Okay.
I'm wondering, how does one find an agent? And are agents specific to, say, picture books or
so different levels? The question was about agents.
It can happen in a variety of ways. I've had 3 agents, and every time I've had 4. but anyway, I had some stories that were in the magazine, The New Yorker, and so some agents wrote me because of that, so I didn't have to go out there. But then later, after I left that agent, I had to go out and query agents, and so I got an agent then. And my current agent, I wrote 4, including this one, I wrote 4 kids' books with no agent, and then I went and got an agent, and she was recommended to me by my editor. So every time it was a different way, really. How did I go about finding someone? Sometimes if you look at the beginning of books, it'll say something about the agent. So I knew what kind of book the agent liked.
And I don't have an agent now. I did for about 5 years, and we parted ways. It wasn't that it wasn't working. It just seemed like the right time to move on at that point. There are many ways that you can find agent listings. You should make sure that you whoever you sign up with is a bona fide member of the, it's called the, it's AAR, the Association of
Author and representatives.
Author and artist representatives or something like that. It's AAR anyway, and they have a website, and they have agents who are members of AAR are more likely to be, you know, on the up and up, and they're not going to, you should never go to an agent who charges you a reading fee, for one thing. So, and then there's a site called Predators and Editors, that has this listing of, you know, questionable agents. They're, alas, at this point, right now, being sued by one of the questionable agents. But they've been a very valuable site for a lot of people.
You know, and just to define it, agents is actually like a gatekeeper for the publishers in a way. I mean, that agent represents your interest, but they... And in children's literature, it's a little different than literature for grown-ups because, as Uma has expressed, you can go to some publishers directly. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily have to go to an agent. And you could talk to Uma a little more about that. It is nice. My experience, since I write more for adults, is because you have that advocate. And I'm not really good at advocating for myself. And in terms of, it could range from the advance to the cover consultation, and you know, your agent can kind of go after that. But there is a site called agentquery.com, and that's another site. And also, if you're really interested specifically in children's literature, there's a Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, and I think the site is scwi.org. Yeah. And they are they're international, so you could probably find a chapter in your area, and that way you could network with other people and, you know, hear from them, their experience with agents. Sometimes they have, you know, these agent workshops, which are helpful. And also they offer workshops for writing. I found my agent kind of the way Cynthia did. She had signed me on. I hadn't met her for like a year. You know, people think, oh, did they fly you over to New York? It's like, no. And I hadn't met my editor for a while either. I mean, it's, you know, especially in this age of the internet, so much of the business is, you know, conducted. And you're typically, you don't get a whole lot of money, especially if you're a debut author. So there's no reason for them to spend the money on you going over to New York. But it's through the acknowledgments page. I saw a mystery that was doing something similar to what I was attempting to do. And I just said, oh, and to my agent, you know, I go, okay, I'll put that one down. And this book actually was about an African-American maid who solved crimes. You know, so it wasn't, you know, sometimes when you're writing about Asian Americans, you think, well, I need to find an agent who represents Asian Americans. And I don't think you need to look at it so narrowly. You need to, you know, because I think agents are looking for good stories, and it doesn't really matter where they're from. Yes.
So the question is, how do you go about finding illustrators for picture books, and how do the royalties get split? The royalties get split 50-50, and it's always that way, and the contracts are drawn up separately with the author and the illustrator. But you don't find your own illustrator, is the short answer. Is that you submit the manuscript to the publisher, and if it is accepted, then the publisher starts to look for an illustrator whose work will mesh with your words, or who will bring an extra luster to your story, or whose style kind of seems to work. And they have a whole art department that's really dedicated to, you know, rustling up really fabulous illustrators. They know an awful lot more about the art than I ever will. The way it works is that really that's the publisher's job. Now, because many of my stories are culturally specific, I'm always concerned that the art should be at least realistic in that sense, that it should represent what it's setting out to represent. And so usually in my picture book contracts, I will at least try to get them to send me roughs of the artwork when it's in progress. And I have to say that with most of my books, that's happened, and I've been very pleased with the results. With Monsoon, for instance, I actually got to send pictures of the setting and signs for shops and things like that, because the illustrator lived in England and he was of Malaysian origin and he didn't quite know the region of India in which that book was set. So I really had to make sure that it was all real. They have been generous in letting me do that. But usually they try to keep you apart. They don't want the author hovering.
Why don't you guys, I know we have a few more questions, but about covers. I mean, I think a lot of presumptions people have is you get to choose the artist who does the illustration. So how about that?
I don't have cover. I don't have to approve the cover. It's not in my contract, and my agent actually did try to get it into the contract but couldn't. So they always run the cover by me, but if they loved it and I hated it, I think they would use it anyway.
And we had an issue with the original cover of Naming Maya was it really didn't work. And I think my editor actually sent it to me hoping that I would say that it really didn't work so that then she could take it to marketing and she would say, see, the author hates it too, because it turned out that she actually hated it. But she didn't tell me that at first. She just said, I'm faxing you the cover, see what you think. And I got this cover and I'm going, wait a minute, this is not the book. This has any resemblance between this and the story is just coincidence. But then when we had the conversation, it turned out she actually took my email response to that cover, and then she took the cover and she plunked them down on the marketing person's desk and said, seriously, would you buy this book? Mm-hmm. And the marketing person said, seriously, no. So they actually went back to square one and did a whole new cover for the book.
Yes. So writing habits. Yeah.
I used to write in the middle of the night. I'm really a night person, but I adopted my son, and I really had to change. I have to write during the day. So now I have this. It's almost like a job. I get up. My babysitter picks up Sammy. Then I start to work. But I yearn for those nighttime writing binges.
I used to write at night. When I first got started, my son was about a year old, and so I would wait till he'd gone to bed, and then I would come down and write. Even though I'm actually not a night person, that sort of was a pattern that I fell into. And now he's 21 years old. He's not at home anymore. It's like, I have these days. It's quite amazing. So I write too, but I also teach. So I have 1 week a month that's my teaching week, and I just don't do any writing during that time. I only work with student manuscripts during that time. And then the rest of the time, I write.
And Gil? So self-publishing or alternative ways of publishing and blogging.
When books are out of print now, there's a thing called e-reads. And so they'll, it's like print on demand. If anybody orders your book from Amazon, they can send it out to the person. And it's just the same as if you were buying it. So I have my my grown-up books, one of them is sold that way. Another one is sold by the University of California. And then another one is just out of print. So I guess you could do that anyway. I'm sorry, what was the other part of the question? Oh, I don't blog, no. I don't blog because I think it would take away from my writing energy.
I got browbeaten into blogging, really. And I sort of started it because I wasn't going to at first because I was really worried about that taking away. If I use up my limited writing energy in blogging, then what do I have left to write? So I actually use up some of my teaching energy to do my blog. And my blog is called Writing with a Broken Tusk. And I usually look for, and I don't blog about anything and everything. I'm very selective. I don't blog often. It's just whenever I feel like writing something down, whenever I feel particularly strongly about something, I'll put it on the blog where previously I used to, write on little scraps of paper and I'd never find them again. I have not had any experience with alternate publishing, although not all my books are, you know, sort of big publisher New York books. There, I do publish with a lot of small presses as well. And there was a time when I was transitioning between traditional retold stories and original fiction, and I thought nobody would ever publish me again. And I was just really grateful for those small houses because they kept my name alive and they kept me in print during that time.
Does everyone know what blogging is? Okay, blogging is like web log, and basically it's kind of like a journal or diary, or it could be new, you know, that, and it's, there's a lot of services that are free, and you just, it's for the internet, and you just write your thoughts. A lot of authors, I'm in the mystery genre, and we are known for blatant self-promotion. It's like really ugly, and I participate in it sometimes. And I think now the way people are, I mean, there's so much competition for people's times. And so a lot of times they want to have a relationship with the author. And one way is blogging. And in my opinion, it's not for everybody. I know Gil does it. You know, it's not for everyone. And again, sometimes it may sap your creativity. But on the other hand, sometimes it's a way for you to connect with your audience, especially, you know, it could be younger people. So,
yeah. Right. All writing, I think, ultimately, you have to ask yourself, what is the purpose? Why am I writing this? And who is the audience? Who am I writing this for? And I think blogging is like that, too. Blogs have different purposes and different audiences, and they reach out to them differently.
And there have been cases more for grown-up books where someone who's been blogging, has a very popular blog, has picked up a book contract. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not often, but it does happen. I saw more hands. Question? Yes. And then can you speak into that microphone right there? Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I have a comic book down in the Youth Expo, and I just need reviews. There's a little paper there with a pen. You could write them, and yeah.
So this is your comic book that you created?
Yes.
What's the name of it?
Beneath the Skin.
Beneath the Skin. And what's it about?
Well, basically, it's about where this person is racially discriminated against, and he just gets so sick of it that he basically tears off his skin, and so he's like this kind of skeleton person, and he finds a use for it, and so that's basically the story.
And you create? Did you print it yourself, or is it just on the internet, or how does it work?
Well, I first drew it, then I scanned it onto the computer, and then printed it out, and then basically pasted paper onto other paper, binded it all together, and brought it here.
Cool. And can people take home a copy, or you don't have that many?
I only have one.
Okay. Well, we'll check it out. Go to the youth. And what floor is that? Is that
fourth.
Fourth floor.
And thank you very much. And what is your name?
Joseph Day.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I think here, I mean, we're talking about New York publishing, a very, you know, sophisticated, but it really starts with a seed of a story, you know, as what was shown. And you can get sometimes too caught up in all the business parts of it, which is important. But you also, you know, however you need to express your story, if you just need to do a comic book and Xerox it, that's how, like, I think in the 90s, a lot of these zines, I don't know if you've heard of zines, were started, and people just, you know, they would do guerrilla marketing. This is not kosher, but they would go into places they worked and use their company's Xerox machines to create and then staple it and give it. And actually, I think that's how a publication Giant Robot was started, and now it's a really slick publication. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's great. You know, and I think now with a new technology, you know, you mentioned scanning, there's a lot of different ways you could reproduce this. And as Gil mentioned before, there's a place called Lulu.com where you don't have to pay anything up front to get your book published. They just charge per book, and it's called print on demand, and it's basically a really fancy photocopy machine, and it, you know, you could get, and there's downsides to that as well, but you know, there's a lot of different options for people these days. I think we have time for maybe one more question. One or two? Yes.
Go ahead.
Boys reading and technology.
No, I don't have any advice. My nephew actually read a lot when he was young. He always had a book. They couldn't keep him with enough. They couldn't get enough books for him. And then he discovered gaming, and he did a. When he was graduating from high school, all the seniors had to give a talk to all the other seniors. And it's his topic. He chose why gaming is better than reading. And apparently he got a rousing ovation. So,
John Teschke has a site called guysread.com. Just Google Guys Read, books for boys, and you'll see this website, because there's this big push to get boys reading again, because we're losing boys to gaming. Yeah, my son is a game developer at this point, so he's part of that industry. I think, you know, I'm seeing the form of picture books really changing. The kinds of illustrations that are being done are much more, you know, they're many more illustrators are, for instance, manipulating the designs on the computer than they ever did before. And the designs of books tend to illustrate that. People are playing more with the form of the page. So there's stories that kind of march off the page and come back again as a different story, that kind of thing. I think the book is going to have to change if it's going to survive.
Yes. Are they boys though?
Boys and girls.
Oh, okay. Are they reading Harry Potter or what are they reading? So I guess there's hope.
Yeah.
There's hope. One last thing, Kay.
I'm curious about your writing process, the process. You mentioned, Uma, that you don't always know the end of your story, but an example of what I'm speaking of, when do you figure out the ending and so forth? Does it just evolve, or is it something you figure right away?
Writing process and endings.
I feel as if I always know the ending when I start.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I never do. I never do. I have to write and rewrite. I'm very wasteful. I write lots of beginnings and throw them away. My writing group once joked that I should, you know, rent out those beginnings. Like, you too can find your story with this fine opening.
You know, with mysteries, you would think you would know who did it. A lot of times I don't know until, you know, the story kind of emerges. And I think all of us would agree, we have to wait for the character to kind of take hold of us. And I think sometimes people push too hard with their stories and their character falls flat and it becomes two-dimensional. It's really hard to explain because some of it's so intuitive, but I think it's, in that way you have to be really careful. I mean, there's a craft aspect, definitely. So, you know, take those writing classes to learn about plot and all those things. But there's this magical side to it, too, that I feel very hard to explain.
Yeah.
And it, yeah.
Are you telling me that there's that I could actually write a mystery that way?
Yeah, you can.
Really? You give me hope.
Yeah. A lot, and some mystery writers outline, and many don't. Huh. You know, it just sort of happens. So
I always just thought of a mystery as one of those perfectly plotted things, and they so often are.
Yeah,
and,
but there's different kinds of mystery now. They're becoming more character-driven.
True.
Yeah. So I think, are we all out of time now? Okay.
Maybe the three of you can do a final plug of your books and let people know where to get them.
Okay. When did you start, Uma?
I don't have a new book out this year, so
okay.
And the one I have is Chatterjee's Cup, and it was out in 2003, so it's been around a while.
And where can people find that?
They're selling them
they're
here.
They're selling them here, I think.
They're selling like three or four of your books here.
Okay, we had a couple questions about the authors. If you have books out there, if people wanted to know if you could sign them, I'm not sure how to hook that up. So.
Of course.
Can they just come talk to you?
I think I was told I should go there now, like after this session. So
okay.
So go to the Tattered Cover booth. Yeah.
Okay. This is my new novel. It's called Outside Beauty. And as I said, it's my first novel for older kids. And it's about a girl. The main character has three sisters, and they all have different fathers, but the same mother. And it's just about what happens to them and how they all have to go live with their fathers.
And this is coming out in August, 1001 Cranes. And in the back is a blurb from Cynthia. And my publisher was so delighted, like, you got a Newbery Award winner to blurb your book? But this takes place in Gardena, California. And it's about love, marriage, and divorce, and a lot of origami cranes. So I'll be doing a lot of folding at these events. But this is my first book for children. But I'm also working on the next Masarai. I write a series with a Japanese-American gardener who solves crimes. So the next one's coming out. It's due at the end of this, talking about deadlines, due at the end of this year.
Well, thank you very much to Naomi, Cynthia, and Uma.